Our next speaker was both a student and a faculty colleague of Enrico Fermi, spanning the late 1940s until about 1950. This is Richard Garwin, who will now tell us about his experiences with Fermi. I forget the title. Here's the title.
Thank you. Well, Enrico Fermi's work speaks for itself, but you probably haven't read it all, and neither have I. So here are some firsthand recollections from a very imperfect observer. I have here a website, and so if you go to garwin.us, you can search many, many papers, mostly policy papers, but growing number of actual physics papers on that website. I posted two talks there from the 2001 centennial year of Fermi's birth, and I've modified those and added a few pictures, courtesy of my friends and colleagues, Harold Agnew and Jay O'Rear. I came to Chicago for graduate work in physics in 1947 with my wife Lois, and after some months of courses decided that I needed to do some experimental work, which is my interest and my strength. So I got up my courage and I went to Professor Fermi and volunteered to help in his lab, which turned out to be a good thing for me to have done. I discovered that he had in his laboratory a machine shop, his own lathe, cutoff saw, and the like. He had great respect for the ability of the central shops at Chicago, but he felt they were too fastidious, and you could put a job into the shop and get it back 10 times longer than it would take and 10 times more accurate than was necessary. So he made a lot of his own equipment, and that was my tendency too. I'll show you one piece of his equipment. In his lab, I found also Leona Woods Marshall. Fermi and Leona had just done some work on electron-neutron interaction, and Jack Steinberger, who was off in one corner with trays of long brass Geiger counters and piles of graphite and lead looking at cosmic ray muon decay. Fermi and Marshall were doing an experiment on positron annihilation on a bench in the lab using glass Geiger counter tubes that they sealed up themselves, each with a little string of 12.5-hour half-life sodium-22. Beta-plus active material would yield a positron, which would then annihilate. But Martin Deutsch at MIT was studying this too, and he scooped them because he had access to scintillation counters with 2-inch diameter end-window developmental phototubes from RCA. Eventually, Fermi got such phototubes, and we decided we would put them to work. At that time, the electronics was rather primitive, using Rossi coincidence circuits, you saw Rossi, from the 1930s, which had microsecond resolving time, and Geiger counters with 100 microsecond dead time. So it was time to invest in building things that could be used more efficiently for the future. I looked into these matters and built and published some fast pulsers and coincidence circuits, which were in the few nanoseconds rather than the microsecond range, using what would now be called vacuum tube current switch technology and a self-adapting diode clamp. These were widely used for a decade or more at Chicago and elsewhere. I remember how sad I felt when Fermi's technician left for another job. The great physicist, still in his prime at 47, was dependent to some extent upon the support of this young man. And yet Fermi realized that the young person had to move on in order to have a career, and Fermi had to start again with somebody else and show him how to do the work. Fermi's propensity for building his own equipment was shown when the 450 MeV cyclotron was put into operation. First, the construction of the cyclotron, for which a lot of problems with high-power radio frequencies came in spades. When you build such a thing which has the requirement to provide an electric field over a large area, the problem with the computer, I'll have to fix it. You put it together and you find all of the RF power leaks out someplace else. Something burns up. That's even more of a problem when the frequency is swept over a substantial range. as is the case with the synchrocyclotron, where the mass of the proton increases, I'll spare you this, from 938 MeV at rest to 938 plus 450 MeV when it has been accelerated. The frequency changes in a reciprocal fashion. Fermi would meet every morning at 7:30 with the engineers, Leroy Schwartz and colleagues, listen to their report on the problems and prospects of cyclotron activity, talk to them about the analyses he had made of the progress from the previous day, and then he'd go about his other work and hear from them either later that evening or the next morning. Fermi's advice was invaluable in conquering parasitic oscillations of the RF system. When the cyclotron returned to work, there were beams to be brought out and targets to be positioned within the cyclotron. Rather than having a large number of targets mounted on probes, I'm doing that.
Nothing on the screen.
Yes. I know, because I'm restarting.
Okay.
I apologize. It's actually the computer's fault. Rather than having a large number of targets mounted on probes penetrating the vacuum chamber that could be plunged into position, Fermi conceived of a movable target, a trolley that would move along the rim of the cyclotron. He took advantage of all of the characteristics of the cyclotron. It has an intense magnetic field, so to build a motor, you don't need to provide for a magnetic field. It's there, a stronger field than any motor. The cyclotron had a circumferentially ridged pole, and so Fermi could build a cart that would move along the pole in a circumferential manner. The cart had a little copper or carbon target weighing a few grams that could be flipped into the beam by another coil mounted on the trolley. And after the trolley was made, he decided to put in a thermocouple on the target to measure the power dissipated there in ionization and nuclear interactions. It could not have been more perfect. I remember that about 35 watts of target dissipation was pretty good behavior for the cyclotron. Although Fermi could control the cyclotron very well, less capable people were bothered by the time lag. You know, there's this mass that has to be heated up. It was painted black with Aquadag so it would radiate the power in the vacuum. And there was about, as I recall, a 90-second time lag between changing the beam incident on the target and the target's assumption of a new temperature as measured by the thermocouple. So I built a little circuit to anticipate the result. It was mounted in a panel in the control room. You could control the cyclotron, and instead of the 90-second lag, there was an irreducible couple-of-second lag to perceive the result of the adjustment. So it's reasonably easy to tune up. Fermi was interested in calculating wave functions of nucleons in peculiar nuclear potentials. There were Feinberg models, Jastrow models of the nuclear potentials, among others. One day I came into Fermi's lab in Ryerson Hall, and he had a coil, or maybe it was in this case a bar magnet, suspended as a torsion pendulum on a lab bench. He was going to make an analog computer. The analog of the spatial distribution of the one-dimensional particle wave function was going to be the time behavior of this torsion pendulum. And the analog of the prescribed potential, V of X, would be the current fed to the coil as a function of time as a restoring torque coefficient. It's a perfect analogy for small angles. Now, if we were going to do this, we would need to record the position of the needle with respect to time and to give it the current as a function of time. So Jack Steinberger remembers that I said, "Professor Fermi, you've got better things to do. Let me do this." So I did, and I built an all-electronic analog computer that used just operational amplifiers. It was a whole rack of equipment in those days with special op-amps that I designed that used plus and minus 600-volt supplies and had a curve follower so you could input the potential V of X. After Fermi's death, Clyde Hutchinson used it, but nobody else to my knowledge. Among my regrets is the failure to respond to one of Fermi's questions. Cited already by TD. When I received my PhD in December 49 and joined the faculty of the physics department, I had my own laboratory at the Institute of Nuclear Studies. I was busy doing experiments on the 100 MeV betatron, planning experiments with a cyclotron, getting ideas where I could, including scintillation counter ideas from Gorang Yod and others. Fermi came in one day and, in typical fashion, I had missed the seminar, asked whether I had thought about including spin-orbit interaction in the calculation of nuclear wave functions and energy levels. So I thought about that. 2 weeks later, he came back and asked what progress I had made, and I told him none. So he said he would talk to Maria Mayer about it. I had simply lacked the courage to put down what I was doing to take up a new challenge where, in fact, I would probably not have done nearly so well as Maria. In those days, Chicago paid nine-month salaries. You could either starve or get government contracts for the other 3 months, and I was unwilling to do either. Fermi suggested I could be a consultant to Los Alamos. Rumor has it, though I don't recall, that I'd made some suggestions to him about nuclear weapons, and he said the place to discuss such things was at Los Alamos. Fermi and his wife Laura were there when we got there in 1950 for the summer with our six-month-old son Jeffrey. And I shared an office with Enrico Fermi, which was a good experience. People would come in and talk to him. During the war, he had gone to Los Alamos, not when the laboratory was formed in March of 1943, because he was busy in Chicago helping to design the plutonium production reactor at Hanford after his achievement of the first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction at Chicago, December 2, 1942. Fermi arrived at Los Alamos in the fall of 1944 and worked there through 1945. He was not in charge of any development group, although there was an F division for Fermi, but he was a treasured consultant known as the Pope. Anyone needing the result of a calculation or experiment could ask Enrico, and one way or another, he would either show them how to estimate or, in extremis, he would provide an answer. Notably, Edward Teller and a couple of his assistants working on thermonuclear weapons were assigned to F Division. He was also accessible as a friend. At Chicago and at Los Alamos, as had been the case in Italy, Fermi was proud of his acute vision, his stamina, and his physical achievements. With his dog paddle stroke in Lake Michigan, he was able to forge ahead of collegiate swimmers and return to encourage their progress, much to their frustration. His steady step up mountains left much younger sprinters in the dust. He loved to ski, but he was not a good fisherman and opined to Emilio Segre, who was an avid fisherman, that it would be more sporting to use a line with a hook on either end, the fisherman holding one in his mouth as he sought his quarry. Into our office at Los Alamos came Fred Reines in 1950, suggesting that maybe with all of these nuclear explosions at the Nevada test site, he could put a detector underground and detect the antineutrinos from the beta decay of the moles of fission products that were made in the explosion. Fermi pointed out that a nuclear reactor, one of our modern reactors anyhow, burns a couple of kilograms of uranium-235 a day, and that fission of 1 kilogram of uranium in a nuclear weapon gives only 17 kilotons. So there are lots more neutrinos available from a reactor, and you can get closer to it. So Fermi's suggestion to Fred Reines led him to do the more feasible continuous experiment at reactors, for which Fred, in 1995, received the Nobel Prize. Of course, physicists, especially experimental physicists, have a lab notebook, and mine at Los Alamos, which I obtained on the first day I was there in 1950, was classified secret, restricted data. So that's 60 years ago. It went into my safe whenever I was not actually using it. Fermi preferred to keep his work unclassified, so he occasionally wrote in my notebook, either for my edification, or because the work was truly classified, or because it was uncertain whether it was or not. So when I get the pictures back up, I'll show you the first of 7 pages in Fermi's own hand of the near and far field disturbance from a nuclear explosion in an underground cavity. I would characterize his calculation as earth-shaking, literally, but not figuratively. when I show you the picture, those of you who know about the extensive efforts on detection of distant underground nuclear explosions by seismic signals, and the flip side of that coin, the possibility of reducing the seismic signal by using a large enough cavity so that the rock remains in the elastic range, we'll recognize from the first few lines that Fermi has taken a 100 kiloton explosion in a 33-meter radius cavity, just a bit larger than the cavity radius that will fully decouple a mere 1 kiloton explosion. So that's the picture that figures in J. O'Rear's book, which is available on the web and is well worth reading. Here is the famous trolley to hold the target of the Chicago cyclotron. So wheels to move along the ridged pole. This is the outside, obviously. The target is over there. Another coil for flipping it up. Two little coils down here that a control box could be used to move the trolley along as if it were geared to the cyclotron rim. Most of Fermi's team, the first to achieve a self-sustaining nuclear reaction. This picture was taken in 1946. And at Los Alamos, Fermi, with Maria Martinez, a renowned potter and a grandchild, a photo from the San Ildefonso Pueblo open house, courtesy of Harold Agnew. And here, from my notebook, LAMB3616, for anybody who wants to check, explosion in underground cavity, with total energy of 5 times 10 to the 21 ergs. We did not use SI units in those days. And initial volume. And Fermi estimated under these circumstances 5% of the explosive energy was radiated as seismic waves. Fermi and Stanislaw Ulam would work together at Fermi's desk this first summer in 1950 on calculations for the burning of a cylinder of deuterium. Liquid deuterium, the classical super, which had been Fermi's original suggestion in 1941 to Edward Teller, that had caught fire with Teller, but not in reality. The classical super turned out to be very difficult, maybe barely feasible now. I won't detail the difficulties. Fermi would start with an accountant spreadsheet, a Marchant electrically driven desk calculator, and a slide rule. You saw a slide rule, for those of you who don't know what that is. Having converted the partial differential equations that were involved to first-order differential equations, he would fill in the first few rows of the spreadsheet, a real accountant spreadsheet. Time would march down the spreadsheet, and he and Stan would talk about the parameters. And then their computer would take over, which was Miriam Caldwell. Overnight, she would complete the spreadsheet that Fermi had begun and would return the next morning. She used the same tools, with the completed product. Fermi and Ulam would graph the results and give the computer the next problem. Their results were published in the classified document LA1158 of 1950. Part of my own work that summer of 1950 was to begin an experiment to measure the DD and DT cross-sections that had been measured 10 years previously at the University of Texas by Tom Bonner. I thought it was a pretty weak reed to lean on in deciding to build hydrogen bombs or not when you didn't really know what the cross-sections were. So I devised and began to build the equipment. When I had to leave at the end of the summer to return to my responsibilities at Chicago, Fermi encouraged physics division leader Jerry Kellogg and laboratory director Norris Bradbury to import Jim Tuck from England. He'd been at Los Alamos during the war to continue this work, which was then published in 1954. I worked also on the diagnostics of nuclear explosions. The first couple of weeks that I was at Los Alamos in 1950, I spent in the classified report library reading the weekly reports of all the groups from the labs beginning in 1943. In 1951, I was back for the summer. I didn't share an office with Fermi. Physics division decided I would be better off as a consultant to the theoretical division. I don't know whether they asked the theoretical division that. And that's where I was ever after in my summers at Los Alamos. Fermi was concerned that summer with a large number of things, including Taylor instability. If you have a stable interface like that in a glass or bottle of water, you can make waves run on it. You jiggle it, you can see the standing waves there. and I decided to spare the warden and park the actual experiment, which I will now describe. But most children know also to put a card over a full glass of water and to turn it upside down, and the water stays in the glass. It's stable. That is, the atmospheric pressure is equal to the pressure just above the card, so why should it fall out? But it's metastable. If you take the card off, the interface is still supported briefly. You can take the card out by the air pressure, but the water pretty soon falls out. Why? It's a very important phenomenon in nuclear weaponry as well as in many other fields, and had been plaguing the people at Los Alamos ever since they considered implosion weapons in 1942. But they unexpectedly had actually to make them in order to use plutonium when they discovered the high spontaneous fission rate of reactor-produced plutonium in 1944. Fermi had schematized the problem on his blackboard. For the initial phases of Taylor instability, you assume a ripple on the surface, and instead of behaving sinusoidally with the restoring force due to gravity or to capillarity, it behaves exponentially in time with the same time behavior, except the coefficients that is imaginary instead of real, or vice versa. So there's a time in which the amplitude doubles. The next interval, it doubles again. The next interval, it gets to be eight times as large as the initial. And pretty soon, this can't go on because the energy in the instability exceeds the energy that was driving it. Velocity exceeds the velocity of light. And so the question is, what happens at large amplitudes? Well, Fermi said, let's make a 2D model, so ripples that go this way across the surface. I'll have a broad tongue as the material moves away from the surface, and it's periodic spatially, and then a broad tongue that moves into the dense material and a narrow tongue that moves away and falls. And I'll just solve this problem numerically. So he did some of that. As a function of time, the tongue narrows and deepens. And he wasn't quite satisfied with the solution. One afternoon around 4:50 p.m., John von Neumann came by and saw what Fermi had on the blackboard and asked what he was doing. So Enrico told him, and John von Neumann said, that's very interesting. He came back about 15 minutes later and wrote on the blackboard how to approach the problem analytically. Fermi leaned against his doorpost and he told me, you know, that man makes me feel I know no mathematics at all. Fermi used to say he could solve only six problems, but he was very good at transforming any other problem into one of those six. And he was truly an expert on the hypergeometric function. Fermi's crude approximation of September 1951 is published as number 244 in the collected papers of Enrico Fermi. It shows the narrow tongue proceeding into vacuum with a large amplitude uniform acceleration of 1/7 g. The more rigorous analytical calculation with von Neumann is number 245. The limiting acceleration is still 1/7 g. Fermi had it very right. If the problem is this Taylor unstable interface between two incompressible fluids instead of one and vacuum, the result is naturally multiplied by the fractional difference in density. Fermi had often done hand calculations such as those with Ulam on the classical super, so he was open to the wondrous advances of the first electronic computers at Los Alamos, the MANIAC. A copy of the Princeton Institute JOHNIAC, built by von Neumann and Hermann Goldstein. The first calculation was performed by Fermi and Nick Metropoulos and appears as number 256 in collected papers with a foreword by Metropoulos. The paper indicates, incidentally, the speed of the MANIAC, a hand calculation that takes 20 minutes by Marchand and slide rule, takes only 0.4 seconds on the MANIAC. The MANIAC could perform about 10,000 fixed-point operations per second, to be compared with the billions of operations per second on your few hundred-dollar laptop, almost a million times as fast. Fermi had always been interested in the ergodic theorem and in understanding the approach to thermal equilibrium or to random distribution. He had the idea of using the MANIAC to calculate the behavior of a chain of loosely coupled harmonic mass spring oscillators, for which the coupling energy between adjacent masses had not only the usual quadratic form for the energy in displacement difference, but also a small cubic term. And it's easy to estimate the time required for the damping of the fundamental mode by transfer of the energy to higher modes in this conservative system. For a small cubic term, you still have the normal modes. And paper number 266, 1955, published after Fermi's death, summarizes this work. A foreword by Ulam notes Fermi's surprise at the results, which several of us experienced personally. After thousands of computing cycles and what appears to be approaching equal partition among the modes of oscillations, almost all the energy returns to the initial mode. With further great cycles, the energy in the initial mode is reduced by, say, 1% per great cycle, so it doesn't quite come back. But after 16 great cycles, the energy in the initial mode returns within 1%. So marvelous results, which founded another field analytically. There was another time at Chicago when our colleague Edward Teller, who was also on the faculty, came by and told Fermi of his most recent enthusiasm. After Teller left, Fermi commented, "That's the one monomaniac I know with more than one mania." I left the University of Chicago in December 52 for the IBM laboratory at Columbia University to change my focus from particle physics to condensed matter physics. I didn't like having to tell people 6 weeks in advance what I wanted to do with the cyclotron or to work with a team of six people. Now, of course, it's 60 weeks in advance and 600 people, so I think I made the right choice for me. But I certainly admire what has been done in particle physics since. I did work at IBM on superconductors and liquid and solid helium, and I continued to work summers at Los Alamos. I didn't realize how much I would miss the daily contact with Fermi. By 1954, I had worked for a year sort of half-time on air defense of the United States and made contact with people in Washington outside the nuclear weapons community. Hearing of Fermi's illness, I returned to Chicago, I think in October, and saw him in his house. He had an inoperable cancer of the lining of the stomach. We talked for an hour or so. He regretted not having been more involved with public policy about nuclear weapons, for example. I was, of course, terribly saddened that Enrico Fermi was taken from us at the age of 53. I just imagine his joy had he been around to see the evolution of computers and the development of physics and the role he might have played had he lived another 30 years to be as old as I am now. As one of his students put it in 2001, we were all smarter when Fermi was around. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick, for a great talk. Now we have time for questions. Bruno.
Dick, in the first period of Fermi in Los Alamos, I learned from Bruno Rossi that he had problems with the director of the laboratory. And Bruno was kind of mediating in Italian between him and the director of the laboratory. Apparently, do you know anything about that period?
Nothing about it. You know, people who were at Los Alamos thought that Oppenheimer was a very great director. You know, despite all of the experience they'd had with him at Caltech and Berkeley, he was an excellent director, underestimating the physical resources and personnel resources that were necessary. But Fermi didn't go there until the fall of 1944, after a year and a half. And the first I've heard of any problems. Fermi didn't have problems with people.
Well, in fact, I'm quite sure Jerry can confirm it, that he was given jokes that were not to his stature.
Yeah, well, I don't know anything about it.
More questions?
Yes.
Well, Fermi spent this summer of 52 at Los Alamos, as you see on the slide here, and when he went back to Chicago that next fall, he gave a series of seminars. I don't know if there was a class or a series of seminars, but anyway, on explaining about these new devices, these digital computers. But my one comment on the seminars is that at that time I had teaching responsibilities that covered the first half of the time of the seminar time. So I came in the middle of his seminar, and within 2 minutes, I knew what he was talking about. which is really a rare experience. But he had a way of using nouns rather than pronouns at the crucial place, so that if you could go to sleep for part of what he said, when you woke up, you could immediately find your way again. So he's one of the most amazing teachers I have ever known.
Yeah, Fermi was an excellent lecturer. I had to stand in for him a couple of times. A comparison was just striking, I'm sure. But very often people understood everything he was saying, and then they went home and tried to reproduce it and were unable to do something. In fact, one of the coding sheets from those lectures is in Jim Cronin's book of 2004, Fermi Remembered. Back there, there's...
Is it working?
Yeah.
Does it work? Fermi is said to have stated the question in 1950, I think, of if there's extraterrestrial intelligence out there, why isn't it here? Why haven't we seen it? Do you know anything about what he thought about that area?
Well, extraterrestrials?
Yeah.
Well, it was a good question. And I guess Szilard answered that they're here, they're called Hungarians.
May I answer that?
Yeah, please.
I mean, again, a lot of this is secondhand, but I was told that Fermi factored into his calculations the lifetime of a civilization. And he put that at maybe 10,000 years, 5,000 years, or 3,000 years, and that's because a civilization in his mind was a very tenuous thing and would not survive their own destructive circumstances.
Thank you.
More questions? Yes.
You indicated that he regretted not being more involved in policy in that last discussion you had with him. What do you think
he would have brought to the policy table? Experience and good sense at a time when physicists had a great deal of influence because of their experience in creating nuclear weapons and radar, and with engineers, of course, and such. But who knows? It's a terrible struggle, and even Fermi might not have been successful. And it's really interesting how the problems are not what you think they are. If you look on my website, you'll find, for instance, all the discussions of hydrogen bombs, including Fermi and Robbie's dedicated opposition, were because they're essentially unlimited in energy. But that hasn't been the impact of thermonuclear weapons. It's to make them cheaper and safer. So we can make many, many more with the amount of reactor products and uranium-235 we had. My time is up, though.